Good morning. Good to be back here. I'm going to speak until when time's the break? 11. Okay. I'll speak until around 10 till 11, and we'll have about 10 minutes for questions, answers, dialogue. We'll take our break and then come back for a second ongoing reflection, again ending with a little dialogue at the end, ending by noon. Is that right? Good. Okay. We'll start. Initial sense of this book, Integral Christianity. Like to put it into a context, a way I would understand it, and move into the theme of the last chapter. I think here's a basic way of looking at it. Let's say that you had a transparency that you were going to put on an overhead projector. And on this transparency, you would draw a model of the empirical sciences. That is, you would take all the empirical sciences, physiology, biology, astronomy, geology, botany, that is, all the sciences of the knowledge of what can be observed. And since it can be observed, it can be measured. And since it can be measured, there's means to manipulate it, to move it in a certain direction. And so there's the whole body of empirical science. And you would lay out a paradigm of the approaches of that science, the assumptions of science, the methods of science in its various disciplines. And then you have another transparency, which is a transparency of a religious consciousness. That is, it's the consciousness of subjectivity, the consciousness of experience, evolving towards ever greater states of realization. Now, historically, these two, as they've evolved, the latter is much more ancient than the former, the ancient wisdom traditions of awakening. These two have been seen very often at odds with each other. So I was once on a plane some years ago. I was thinking about this recently. And I was taking notes on Meister Eckhart. I was flying to give a retreat on Meister Eckhart. And the person next to me struck up a conversation and wondered what I was doing, and we talked. And he said he was a professor of science at a major university and that he himself was atheist. He said he can find no proof for the non-empirical. There's no empirical proof for the non-empirical. And so if you can't see it, to him that settles that. Let's see. Interestingly enough, what touched me about it was when I told him I was a psychologist, he said, if you don't mind having a personal conversation for a minute. He said, my wife and I were so grief-stricken when our daughter died. And she was a brilliant young woman in graduate school. And we set up a trust for her, for students who major in the discipline she was in. And he wanted to have a little talk about how a gesture like that helps, but it doesn't help. And it dawned on me the shift in consciousness from the empirical, and no empirical evidence for the non-empirical, but likewise no empirical proof for the non-empirical. That is, there's no empirical proof for the non-existence of the non-empirical, because his love for his daughter could not be measured. And so there's that shift into the personal. And these two have been seen all too often at odds with each other. But what if you put the empirical science overhead on the projector, and then you lay the ancient wisdom tradition transparency of evolving religious consciousness on top of it, and then you rotate them and you get it just right and they match. So the integral model is a comprehensive model of reality that forms a new paradigm where the ancient wisdom traditions of the sacred evolving in consciousness pairs up with empirical science as an evolutionary new state of consciousness of humanity and so on. I think that's a way to look at it, what's happening here. And I also see that what the author is doing, Paul Smith, is he's saying, you know, if we look at it this way, how could we look at it specifically in a Christian language? That is, what would be the Christian model to demonstrate that the Christian tradition fits into this integral model? See, how could we see that it's integral to this comprehensive model of reality, a specifically Christian language of a universal model of reality consciousness? And he demonstrates that. In the book, he goes through and demonstrates that in Christian language. And then, as he says, as you go through these stages, these developmental stages, which are interiorly demonstrable. That is, they're not empirically demonstrable, but master and disciple, teacher and student, you can verify markers in the evolution of consciousness. From the standpoint of in-depth psychotherapy, spiritual direction, and so on, there are markers of developmental expansiveness of consciousness. And there's a kind of inner markers of this discernment process evolving towards ever greater states of love consciousness, reality. And he said, let's do this in specifically Christian terms. And he does that. He walks through the different stages and so on. And then the book culminates with this final chapter, which I'm now going to comment on one of God's better ideas, because it's about us. So it has to be pretty special, because anything having to do with us is special. And it's really, if I walk this walk, it brings me to an extraordinary discovery about myself. As I keeps evolving, and I keep checking in, like, where is this taking me to live this way? And it brings me to a very profound, mysterious kind of self-knowledge. Does this make sense so far? Sort of. And he says, and the text that he uses here, that you are the light of the world, is that Jesus approaches, is talking to a large crowd, and he tells them, you are the light of the world. And the author of the book points out that it's not that you are the light of the world because those of you here who believe in me are the light of the world. As in, for example, you are the salt of the earth. And if the salt loses its savor, see? It isn't as if we go forth and baptize in the name of in all nations and so forth, that you are the salt of the world. But somehow there is a certain kind of godly dignity to being a person that precedes and transcends the specific dignity that is born into us when we're born into the Christian community through baptism. Because it's the dignity that's given in the first love of God's personal creation. Let us make the human person in our image and likeness. And so this is the spiritual dignity of all men and women in God's eyes by virtue of being created by God. We might say it's our God-given godly nature. There is our God-given godly nature. It's who we are because God says so. And God creates us in the image of God. And this is our dignity. And then we could say, well, if we look on it in this way, we could then say, Ken Wilber makes a distinction in world religions between surface structures and deep structures. The surface structures are the particular specific beliefs, customs, and rituals of each world religion that makes each religion different than the other. So if this was a synagogue and I was Rabbi Finley, had on my yarmulke, we'd be doing Torah study and opening it up. See? If I was an imam and this was a mosque, see? We'd all have the Holy Quran open on our laps. We'd be looking at this way. See? But we're in the Catholic tradition of the Christian tradition, basically here, the Christian tradition. So it would go like this. There is this universal God-given dignity. And it's in my Christian tradition that I awaken to it. See? That I awaken to it. The Hindu lives out their Hinduism. And they go to temple and they have their devotion to Krishna, whatever path of Hinduism they're in. And it's in their Hindu tradition that they awaken to it. The Buddhists and the Buddhist tradition, it's their Buddhist tradition that they awaken to it. The Muslims, and so they awaken to it. Thomas Merton once said, the world will not survive religion based on tribal consciousness. That based on tribal consciousness, religious people will destroy the world. Because they'll take their specific understanding of God, given to them specifically, equate that specific belief of God with God himself, so that those who do not conform with the specific idea of God are wrong. And so you get all these religious people arguing with each other. But if instead we look on it as an endless metamorphosis of our hearts, like an ongoing yielding and surrendering over of our hearts to the mystery that gives us life, sustains our life, and calls us to itself, then we can, in kind of a kaleidoscope or a polyphony of these traditions, see the underlying unitive light that shines through them all. Thomas Merton once said, the real way to understand Buddhism is not to read a lot of books on Buddhism. He said, it's to meet a holy Buddhist. He said, there's an unmistakable quality of genuineness. Likewise, for the Buddhist to understand Christianity, it's not to take a lot of courses in Christian theology. It's to meet a holy Christian. And in meeting a holy Christian, they meet Christ. And people who gather at the center recognize each other as contemplative men and women on a path of endless transformation. And so this should teach us to respect all traditions as deeply as we respect our own. But it should also help us to respect our own tradition at an even deeper level. It should reconfirm the beauty and the elegance of our way. Open to all these ways as a way to be in the world with our brothers and sisters, as a way to be in dialogue with them in this common enterprise of bearing witness and loving one another and so forth. And this then bears upon then this sense of identity. Well, each expresses it in different ways, but what does this gravitate towards in an understanding of our nature, of who we are? So we together so far?
Yes.
Good. We'll get started. Then we're ready to start. This was my thought. This was my thought in looking at this, like what would be helpful here. What if we were going to write a second volume to this book? And it would go like this, and I'll be kind of cartoonish about it, but kind of the tone that he takes at the last chapter goes like this. I'll speak in the language he speaks. I've been living this way, and now I realize it's brought me to this realization that I am the light of the world. That is, if we think of God as light, if we think as God of light, God radiating out, I am that light. I am the light that shines, and I am the light of God shining in the world. By the way, living in a world that also shines with that light. See? And then I go like this, wow, how cool. See, I'm the light of God. And he says, go forth and live this way. It's kind of an aspiring, uplifting, expansive understanding of the mystery of discipleship, the mystery of what we're called to. Here's volume two. It goes like this. Well, what if instead of appreciating the beauty of this intuition, what if I would commit myself to intimately realizing the beauty of that intuition? See? What if not that I would just assent to the poetic truth that I am the light of God? But how might I intimately experience the light of God as my very life? Now it gets more serious. You see that? See, now it turns towards, see, how, let's say that spirituality is the search to experience what faith proclaims. There is what faith proclaims, and it consoles our hearts. But the spiritual path is trying to experience what faith proclaims. See, how do I experience it directly for myself? As an inner call. Thomas Merton once told me at the monastery, he said, once in a while you'll find someone encouraging you to take this inner desire to turn inward toward this transformation. Once in a while you'll find someone encouraging you to take that desire seriously. But such people are hard to find. Really. They either don't know about it at all, or they give you reasons why you can get to it later. Really. Because it could go like this. Here's how it could go, really. You know, very, very soon now, all this will be taken care of because we'll all be dead. And God will be all in all forever. Really. See, no rush. Why rush? See, we'll realize the infinity of all things soon enough. Meanwhile, we have things to tend to here. You know, St. John of the Cross says, when it comes to the things of God, we must be patient. But God wishes so many people weren't so patient. See, what happens when you realize within your heart an inner desire not to wait until you're dead to wake up? See? If there is a love that loves me so, that it gives itself away as my life, and if the consummation of my longings are to reciprocate that love by giving myself in love to the love that gives itself to me, why postpone the consummation of the union that arises in that reciprocity? This is a deep question inside of a person. And it's a kind of a tugging at our heart. They can go on for a long time, but we don't have anyone to encourage us in it. They don't have anyone to guide us in it. Thomas Merton once said, the greatest scandal of the church is that it no longer bears witness to its mystical heritage. He said, you have people leaving, losing their faith. And he said, they're losing it in church because the church no longer bears witness to the radicality of the love to which it calls us. He said, they're leaving off to go into yoga, go into Buddhism. He said, well, fine. But why are we not bearing witness to the ancient lineage of our awakened hearts? What is Christ consciousness? So the power of the Spirit who dwells in our hearts. With unutterable groanings, Eckhart says, like a woman in labor, giving birth to this realization of this great mystery. That if we think of God as generosity, that the generosity of the infinite is infinite, and we are the generosity of God. How might I experience that? And experience it with the clarity with which I see the palms of my own hands. See, a kind of an inner visceral understanding of what happens when I stand up, of what happens when I sit down. That nothing's missing anywhere. Everything is more holy than we could even begin to say. This is where we're at. And so, kind of what's sad about this book, when you think about it, is it strikes people as a novel idea. Wow, cool. But this is the ancient lineage of the Christian tradition itself. And so how do we circle back around and very carefully look at the classical texts of the Christian mystics who bear witness not just to the truth of this, but bear witness to the path along which we can realize it too. And that's what I'd like for us to look at here together. Does this make sense in a way? Sure. And I'd like to, in the limitations of time, I'd just like to take a walk through some mystics. And what I'd like to do is just gravitate toward the essence of their teaching, where they bear witness to this realization. And I'd like to start with Thomas Merton. And then we'll go to Teresa of Avila, then John of the Cross, like that. We'll just see how far we can get till lunch. But one's more than enough. You know what I mean? Because this kind of holographic one expresses it all. So we'll start with Merton because he's a contemporary, and but he's bearing witness to this tradition. And I have to say, too, that I'm now about to say things and quote texts that I was saying and quoting one of the previous times that I was here speaking to this group, because this is the one thing that I always talk about. So it just so happens I was assigned the chapter of the book that's about the one thing that I always talk about. So it's providential. I want to read a passage by Merton. This is New Seeds of Contemplation. I think it's Pray for Your Own. This is chapter 34 and 35 of New Seeds of Contemplation by Thomas Merton. And here's what I want you to look for in the book relative to the book on integral Christianity. Notice that in this text, Merton is going to be giving witness to the way we customarily walk around experiencing ourselves day by day. Next, he's going to be bearing witness to some underlying ultimate illusion about the way we tend to experience ourselves. That we tend to make a certain assumption about ourselves, namely being autonomously real in our own perceptions, our own thoughts, our own feelings, our own all of that. That he's going to open up or shed light on a fundamental illusion about our customary self-perception. And in that illusion arises our suffering and our confusion. And then he bears witness to that which heals that suffering, which is going to be the realization that you are the light of the world. So I'll read the text. So this is this archetypal, classic wisdom that gravitates towards identity, towards consummation of union. Excuse the sexist language before they knew better. Every one of us is shadowed by an illusory person, a false self. This is the man I want myself to be, but who cannot exist because God does not know anything about him. And to be unknown by God is altogether too much privacy. My false and private self is the one who wants to exist outside the reach of God's will and God's love, outside of reality and outside of life. And such a self cannot help be but an illusion. We are not very good at recognizing illusions, least of all the ones we cherish about ourselves, the ones we are born with and which feed the roots of sin. For most people in the world, there is no greater subjective reality than this false self of theirs, which cannot exist. A life devoted to the cult of this shadow is what is called a life of sin. All sin starts from the assumption that my false self, the self that exists only in my own egocentric desires, is the fundamental reality to which everything else in the universe is ordered. Thus I use up my life in the desire for pleasures, in the thirst for experiences, for power, honor, knowledge, and love, to clothe this false self and construct its nothingness into something objectively real. And I wind experiences around myself and cover myself with pleasure and glory like bandages in order to make myself perceptible to myself as if I were an invisible body that only became visible when something visible covered its surface. But there is no substance under the things with which I am clothed. I am hollow, and my structure of pleasures and ambitions has no foundation. I am objectified in them, but they are all destined by the very contingency to be destroyed. And when they are gone, there will be nothing left of me but my own nakedness and emptiness and hollowness. to tell me that I am my own mistake. The secret of my identity is hidden in the love and mercy of God. But whatever is in God is really identical with Him. For His infinite simplicity admits no division and no distinction. Therefore, I cannot hope to find myself anywhere except in Him. Ultimately, the only way I can be myself is to become identified with Him in whom is hidden the reason and the fulfillment of my existence. Therefore, there is only one problem on which all my existence, my peace, and my happiness depend: to discover myself in discovering God. If I find Him, I will find myself. And if I find my true self, I will find Him. But although this looks simple, it is in reality immensely difficult. In fact, if I am left to myself, it will be utterly impossible. For although I can know something of God's existence and nature by my own reason, there is no human and rational way to which I can arrive at that contact, that possession of Him, which will be the discovery of who He really is and who I am in Him. That is something that no one can ever do alone, nor can anyone in all creation help Him in this work. The only one who can teach me to find God is God Himself alone. It's pretty good, really. See, that I go about caught up in the assumption that I'm no one but the self things happen to. I'm just the conditioned self, conditioned by the conditions in which I live. And my inner peace depends on my ability to control the conditions that surround me that will sustain my perception of myself. Are you okay? I'll be okay. As long as my marriage makes it, I'll be okay. As long as the diagnosis isn't cancer, I'll be okay. As long as I don't lose my job, I'll be okay. As long as I can get this person to pay attention to me, I'll be okay. I'll be okay. I'll be okay if I can maintain the conditions that give me the perception of the person is okay because they're in those conditions. But when those conditions start to unravel on us, as they always do, because we're all sitting here growing older by the minute, see, really melting like candles, seriously. This is a hard thing to pull off, really, because there's a lot of slippage, really, and we're all just unraveling here, trying to carry out a hopeless agenda of maintaining the self that's passing away by the minute. Isn't this true? But what if in this crisis, see, something breaks through? Gabriel Marcel says, you know you've loved someone when you've glimpsed in them that which is too beautiful to die. That's a great statement. See? You know you've learned to discover yourself when you've found within yourself that which is beautiful to die. What is it that when everything is lost, is not lost? And can I find it? Meister Eckhart says, what is the joy that death does not have the power to destroy? And how can I discover it? And what does life add up to if we've not discovered it? This is a deep question for all of us. All of us. And I think this is the territory. And where I think really he also doesn't hear is that, here's the thing. We say, I really want this. This sounds so good to me. See, how can I enter the deathless beauty that's the deepest reality of my life? And here's the catch in it. And this is what, here's the dark night of the soul. And here's the mystery of the cross and the ground of the mind. Here's how this works for us, why this is tricky. This is where the mystics help us. This is where the gospel helps us. Here's what the ego does. Here's the ego. And the ego, illumined by faith, hears this talk. It likes it. It likes it. And it says, I'm going to turn towards the light. But here's what the ego does. Here's what the ego does. It tells God, I really, really want this. I really do. I take you so seriously. Because I know who I really am is hidden in you. And therefore I seek you. And I seek to find you. under one condition. And the condition is that when I cross the finish line into mystical union, my ego will remain intact. So that in crossing the finish line into mystical union, I can become a mystical ego. And finally get the respect I deserve. You know that phrase, you can't get there from here? That really applies here. John of the Cross says, a bird held by a slender thread is held just as much in bondage as a bird held by a great rope if it will not break that thread. The condition under which we come to realize the God-given godly nature of ourself is a willingness to die to the last traces of relying on anything less than an infinite union with infinite love as the basis for our security and identity. To the extent I still hold on to anything less than an infinite union with infinite love as the basis for my security and identity, I cannot, in that attachment to anything less than the infinite, find the fulfillment in the infinite that I seek. I can't get there from here. Just makes sense in a way? It really does. It really does. And then God then says this, I can see how sincere you are. Really, it touches me. Seriously. But I also see the dilemma that you're in, that you're having a very hard time letting go of what's infinitely less than me as a basis for who you are. And therefore, I will help you out by taking away your ability to live on your own terms. And in this kind of sweetness of this paradoxical love, Martin says, we should all get down on our knees right now and thank God we can't live the way we want to. God doesn't let us get away with it. And what we tend to think of are the obstacles are actually paradoxically the way forward. How do we learn to surrender to that which sustains me, even though it protects me from nothing, if you've noticed? It protects us from nothing. This is the mystery of the cross. Whatever it means that God loves us, it does not mean that God protects us from the unfair thing happening. But even though we are not protected, we are unexplainably sustained, come what may, come what may. And can we find it? Can we find it like this? See, so to be the light of the world, yes, you are the light of the world, but you cannot serve two masters. You cannot serve two masters. And the trouble is our heart is divided. We're caught between two things. Here's another image of this. I want to use the image of the alcoholic, of addiction, of this. Let's say we use light as a metaphor, as our operative metaphor for light. To the person who's an alcoholic and they're in their disease, their light is their ability to have their next drink. That is their light. Their darkness is to never drink again. To the family and loved ones of the alcoholic, they're very, very concerned about their loved one because they can see they're trapped in confusion. What they think of as their light is really the darkness that's destroying them. And the light, namely sobriety that they fear, is which they think is darkness, is the light. They're confused. They're confused. And what does the alcoholic have to do? The alcoholic has to hit bottom and know that as convinced that I am, that this alcohol, which gets me through my day, is the alcohol that's destroying me. And through a power greater than myself, I can be restored to sanity. And as I turn from the darkness because I see that it's darkness and turn towards the light, the alcoholic in me thrashes around and tries to pull me back. But only through my higher power can I find the grace to die and letting go of the very thing that I think is sustaining me. And little by little by little, if I undergo this deep inner death, I come to a spiritual awakening. And I can actually express gratitude that for the arduous, painful journey in which I came to this amazing discovery of God's presence in my life. Now the mystics are saying this, we're all addicts. I don't mean at the psychological level of alcohol, or you can't resist that third tray of brownies with whipped cream on it, or whatever your power, or whatever it is. But we're addicted to the finite as being enough for us. But the infinite love that is the architect of our hearts has made our hearts in such a way that nothing less than an infinite union with the infinite will do. And it's never true. Thomas Merton once said, our minds are like crows. They gather up everything that glitters, no matter how uncomfortable our nests get with all that metal in them. See? And we keep gathering together and gathering together what's never enough for us. Really. And then we have to realize something's wrong with this picture. Really, something's not working here. I don't think it's going to work for me if I keep doing this. But if I turn towards what my own awakened heart knows is true, because I've tasted it for myself in my most childlike hour, and surrender to the love that has accessed my heart to lead me to itself, I find my way like this. And as I undergo that metamorphosis, I come to this deep realization that I am the light of the world. Next. How do I do this? How do I what's this like concretely to do this? This is Merton, Merton's Palace of Nowhere, page 139. Oh, excuse me. This is Merton's Palace of Nowhere, page 128. Let's say this makes sense so far, what I'm saying here. Do I mean like in the pit of your stomach, intuitively, this rings true? Like there's something authentic about looking at life this way. I know this is true. How then do I proceed? See the question? See, this is the seeker's question. I've been awakened by an awareness of what doesn't work. An endless round of cul-de-sacs over and over and over again. And what has opened up in my heart is an intuitive vision of what does work. When I hear the beauty of the words, it rings true. It consoles me. It consoles me. Thomas Merton used to say, is there a Christian in the house? Please raise your hand. What is the good news? What is this good news? I'm saying. The good news is that I'm loved. We're loved. Through and through and through and through and through and through. Such that no matter what you do to run from it, no matter what you do to betray it, it is infinitely powerless to lessen how infinitely loved you are. That's the truth. And by learning to embrace the vulnerability of that powerlessness, to be anything other than infinitely lovable in fragility, and to turn towards that tenderness and open ourselves to it, is the way. Thomas Merton once said, with God a little sincerity goes a long, long way. And it's when we're sincere in silence before God that we turn towards it. And so we live our life. We're assuming some things now. You're living your daily life grounded in love. You're a person of goodwill. He assumes that. The dignity of human and gift of human existence. Next, that our day-by-day life, guided by love, is illumined by faith. Next, in this day-by-day life illumined by faith, there's this mysterious inner lure towards the experience of what faith proclaims. That God's closer than close, loves me through and through and through and through. I don't just want to know it as something beautiful, like let's all stand and sing hymn 38 with enthusiasm. See, but how can I experience it? Experience it. So we live our life by love, and he says, you can't do it. See, this is our dilemma as human beings, really. Our dilemma is we are powerless to achieve by our own efforts that without which our life remains forever incomplete. We are powerless to achieve by our own efforts that without which life remains forever incomplete. It's always like this. But although we are powerless to attain it by our own efforts, we can freely choose to assume the inner stance that offers the least resistance to being overtaken by the gift of what we cannot attain. Does that make sense in a way? I want to say it again. Although I cannot attain it. And by the way, look how this is true of love. Lovers cannot make the moments of oceanic oneness happen by sheer brute force of their ego. They painfully learn that. But they can choose to assume the inner stance that offers the least resistance to being overtaken by the gift of oceanic love. The poet cannot make the poem happen. By sheer brute force of the will, force the poem out onto the paper. But the poet can assume the inner stance that offers the least resistance to being overtaken by the gift of poetry. And so I have tasted that which I cannot attain. But it attains itself in my inability to attain it. It has accessed my heart, and it is drawing me to itself. And I am going to assume an inner stance that offers the least resistance to being overtaken by what I cannot attain. And this is the way. This is the way. And so, after our break, we'll pick up here. Let's stand and stretch in silence just for a second. We're going to have a little short dialogue for about 5-8 minutes, then take a break. Okay, good. Now be seated. We're going to take a break here in just 10 minutes. And I would like the liberty of going beyond the break time. I'd like to go as late as 5 after 11 instead of 11. So, okay, good. Okay, 10 minutes. Any questions or concerns so far? Anything not clear? About this approach to life-related matters. Yes.
Not only do I want to test this mic and demonstrate the right way to ask questions, because it's all being recorded, but I also want to put before you two words, mystic and humanist. I know some wonderful people who devote their lives to to humankind. For example, I know people who devote their lives to the struggle to rid our planet of nuclear weapons. I don't see this as a mystical struggle. I see it as love of humanity. And I could even suggest that God, in God's deepest self, because of God's love of humanity, God might be a humanist. So is there any point to playing with these concepts? Some people drawn to mysticism, others drawn to people.
I'll respond to this question. It'll take 10 minutes. That's a great question. I'll just respond on how we use these words and how to respond to the question in the light of this approach we're taking here, how to respond to it. Let's say that I want to approach it from the standpoint of how the mystic would see it, how the mystic would hear this question. And we might put it this way. The mystic would see that the humanist is the person who's bearing witness to the inherent goodness and value of the human condition. Because that human condition has an infinite value. The humanist might not experience it as infinite, but that doesn't stop the humanist from bearing witness to it. See? It's godly. It's inherently godly. St. Augustine once said, not everybody that the church has does God have. And not everyone that God has does the church have. You can be a church-going son of a bitch, really. And likewise, you can be a holy person who never crosses the threshold of a church. Why? Because you've given your life over to love and to give yourself in generosity and in love. And that's the inherent godly value of the human life, really. Does that make sense in a way? Next point. This humanistic way, namely the way, let's say, the humanist who gives himself or herself to the goodness of the human situation, to help the suffering world. Next, there is a way to illuminate with faith. So faith bears witness to the infinite value of the humanistic endeavor. It has an infinite value. Now you got to be careful in being religious. Because what you'll do is you'll go like this. Because I have religious awareness of its infinite value, I'm one up on you. Because you're not aware of the infinite value of what you're valuing. And as soon as I do that, it's an ideology of God. In some way, I actually slip back and am not as authentically present, maybe as a non-religious person who's present. Does that make sense in a way? But the authentically religious person is not the person who claims a one-up status. Rather, it's a person who sees through their faith the boundaryless, infinite dimensions of the goodness of the good act. Does this make sense in a way? We've got this way. Next, the mystic would say this. Likewise, just as the humanist is fully expressing the infinite mystery that's given infinitely in all directions, everywhere, with every breath and heartbeat, everything has an infinite value. It's the generosity of God. Just as the humanist bears witness to it, just as the religious person bears witness to it through their beliefs, likewise, there is a way of immediately realizing what utterly transcends the ability to any belief to express. The infinitely unexpressible mystery the belief expresses. So beliefs become like transparent metaphors, like poetic transparent metaphors. I'll put it this way. Here's the example I use. Notice if you don't know somebody very well, how easy it is to say a lot about them. Let me tell you about so-and-so. When you've loved somebody very, very deeply for a long, long time, you hardly know what to say. You also know no matter what you say wouldn't be what you know because you can't say it. And your heart breaks when you try. That's the mystic. The mystic is the one whose heart breaks when they try to put words to the awareness that has graced them in silence. Like, pardon me, I do not speak English. You know, everything's unbearably beautiful in all directions. And everything's beyond the explainable, really. And I live by that. And so it's not gradients of, you know, more and more and more and more. It's gradients of the awareness of what everything unexplainably is. I'll put it that way. Anyone else with anything? Going once, going twice. Well, wait, if you have a question, go ahead.
My question is, we've evolved as a society and as individuals, we're doing our best to continue to evolve consciously. But as a society, you know, we have evolved to train our children much better or much higher consciousness level than we did 7,000 years ago. We've learned a few things. My question is, how can we take the higher levels of consciousness that we're glimpsing and attaining or whatever, and teach our children and help everything around us go? As you said, I think Thomas Merton said, the world can't survive tribal Christianity or tribal religion. How can we bring our world around us? How can we bring a higher consciousness to everything?
Well, first of all, I think that let's say there's real truth to what you're saying, and there's this kind of a societal, cultural evolution and growth For example, things that we're aware of now about parenting were things that were just assumed before about parenting. Hopefully, we've evolved and emerged in terms of developmental states and the impact of violence on children and importance of like that. Dan Siegel's book, Parenting from the Inside Out, and the way psychology, developmental psychology, has helped parents. There's another way in which it's not true, and that there's always been loving parents, always. And so it's complicated. It's true. It helps. Doesn't help. It helps. The question is, how do we, let's say, hearing this, we're benefiting from this evolving understanding of sound parenting. And then how, though, do we instill in our children or in each other as couples in our homes, in our communities? How do we keep pointing beyond this? And my sense is this, that we do that by surrendering to it ourselves in the intimacy of our own hearts, so that the very way in which we talk to people, the very way in which we love them, the very way in which we're with them, they see reflected in our eyes, that we glimpse something in them, see, a value that we recognize that invites them to look deeper to find it too. Does that make sense in a way? So we surrender our, this is this mystery that grace touches the whole world this way, unexplainably. It radiates out and touches the world in ways that we cannot comprehend. The author of The Cloud of Unknowing says, do not think that your spiritual work is limited to where you live, because love is not limited by time nor space. And in the middle of the night, when you surrender to God in silence, the surrender touches the world in ways we do not understand. And so we live by that. The moment Christ was the most powerless, nailed to the cross, is the moment of God's infinite power manifested perfectly in the world. And to this day, we're living in the transformative liberation of that power. So we live by that. Next, we look for moments in dialogue where there's little growing edges. You know, children have struggles, things. We always invite them, or your spouse. We try to help each other. And insofar as the person is open to it, we can talk with them like this. You know, if the person at their own developmental stage is kind of been awakened by meditation or prayer, faith, we can dialogue like this. We can gather in communities like this one, and then carry it out. And I think it goes on like that. Okay, so let's take a break. And what time do we come back from our break? How about 15 minutes? How'd that be? So it's 5 after. At 20 after, we'll resume.